You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nō mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero or the Physics Room. Nō mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate.
Welcome to episode 57 of Art Not Science. My name is Orissa Keane, and I'm the Writing and Publications Coordinator for the Physics Room. In this episode, we share a selection of readings from Correspondence 3.1. Conversations about the weather can no longer be regarded as small talk. Correspondence is a biannual tabloid publishing works for the page, web, and ear as openings into artistic practices and relationships. This issue contains contributions which address making art during a climate crisis, with a particular focus on material matters. In a moment you will hear Raewyn Martin reading Circles and Lines. Stemming from some themes of her doctoral dissertation, this text explores tools for living with and changing with the climate in the context of global capitalism and socioeconomic thinking. Citing Ali Russell Hochschild's allegory of the line and what it means to think in linear terms about an individual's access to collective resources, Raewyn proposes that climate change be met with big-hearted action, reminding us that art has a way of imagining beyond immediate realities. Following this, you will hear a conversation between Isabel Loudon, Melissa McLeod, and I, titled Material Costs. Prior to this conversation, I had been thinking a lot about guilt and its function in artistic practice, particularly in making material choices, and beyond that, in everyday life. But guilt is also sticky, attaching itself to certain things, sometimes prematurely or without justification. Still, our aim should be to preempt the action which causes guilt, shouldn't it? Together we discuss imperfect outcomes, personal best practice standards, and institutional and social pressures. We note the internal conflict artists sometimes face in bringing more matter into a world that already feels full of things. In response to this, I want to say here that contemporary art is necessary. It exists as a way to make sense of our surroundings, consciously or not. It is also unique as a record of current times. Artists will always work with what they're interested in, and what is available to them, meaning that the work is inextricably embedded in social and cultural context. Finally, you will be treated to Lulu Callister Baker's short story, Melancholic Melanella, which provokes us to consider a gruesome solution to eliminating the microplastics which inevitably circulate in our bodies. Galleria Melanella waxworms, which metamorphose into wax moths, are one of the few insect larvae that possess a particular enzyme in their gut microbes which can break down polyethylene products, including polystyrene. Now, here is Raewyn Martin reading Circles and Lines.
Psychologists from the Climate Psychology Alliance, along with activists from groups like Greenpeace, have been suggesting that all humans need to feel the enormity of climate change, but resist defeatism. For many people, the acceleration of climate crisis has led to feelings of paralysis, when we actually need to venture into this reality with our hearts open to survival. Once we make the cognitive and emotional leaps of imagination that enable radical hope, it's more likely that we'll embrace both individual and collective action and be less likely to sit back and let the impacts of climate change be felt unevenly. There's a romanticism within this resistance to defeat. In art and literature, romanticism is visible in the imagery of adventure and brave-hearted, individualistic behaviour that invokes a heroic past. We can't ignore that this heroic past is tied to the frontiers of colonization, and this behavior doesn't necessarily lend itself to rational collective action. However, the 19th century romantic attitude also influenced the intersubjective visions and emancipatory politics of Dada and Surrealist artists, who complicated the narrative of the individual and offered open-hearted leaps of imagination. The historical resonance of that moment reminds us how art has the capacity to envision alternative realities, allowing us to imagine ways of living and loving beyond what feels rationally possible in the present. In doing so, art contributes to the project of building new political imaginaries. In politics, the allegory of the line has been used to illustrate how white working class voters in the United States have internalized the image of a line in which they are waiting for their turn to receive a fair share of public resources and the financial and social advantages of capitalism, jobs, housing, health services, etc. The people in the line aren't necessarily expecting huge material gains, but simple middle-class wealth and basic social services. Despite ongoing claims to American exceptionalism, this progression and access hasn't ever been available to everyone, and it has become even harder to access over the past 50 years. The line comes into play in emergency situations too, and has become important over the past decade as extreme weather events and the need for disaster relief has increased. When one sense of access to resources is imagined as linear, it becomes easy to perceive anyone else entering that line as decreasing your own access. At the same time, it becomes easy to perceive other concerns or shared challenges as distractions and slowdowns of the line. Regulation and collective action on climate change become an affront to your personal rights of progression, for example. Meanwhile, recovering from an extreme weather event, you might find yourself back in another line, waiting on emergency and rebuilding support that you need because of global heating. The line allegory was developed by Arlie Russell Hochschild, a sociologist who has researched emotional drivers within politics. She believes that working class people who are attached to the idea of the line and end up voting against their own best interests due to overwhelming resentment are exercising anger but also huge underlying grief. Hochschild also theorized the concept of emotional self-regulation as a form of service work known as emotional labor. Reading her work on emotional labor, I started thinking about how different linear and circular allegories might influence the processes of emotional self-regulation that emerge during crises. Images of lines and circles both generate and temper expectations of how wealth and resources are distributed. Waveforms. It's really hard to change an internalized image once it has a grip on your psyche. The thought experiment of imagining alternative imagery is an important one right now. In 2011, Occupy Wall Street attempted to use data visualization through typographic representation of the 1%, raising consciousness of unequal distribution of wealth and power in a way that could change our sense of how wealth is concentrated in the current system. In turn, this concentration undermines distribution via any imagined line. Astra Taylor creates an image of capitalism as an ongoing wave of destruction, inciting scarcity and precarity in an age of insecurity where capitalism is an insecurity-generating machine. In physics, waves distribute energy or force with varying degrees of impact and duration, and can be represented as fluctuating lines. Taylor's wave forms of capitalist destruction might also be represented in this way, and experienced as cycles of interference within the line. Similar ideas emerged in the 1940s. Joseph Schumpeter wrote that capitalism works through gales of creative destruction. It necessarily destroys wealth to create new wealth. Following this logic, defeatism within the climate crisis would allow the gales of creative destruction to play out within communities who don't have the resources to adapt. There's a bunch of scholarship being done around these ideas now, and I picked up on the links between these terms while I was listening to a podcast in the studio recently. NPR guest Jack Beatty noted that two generations of Americans have experienced these increased gales of creative destruction since the 1970s. Contemporary references to Schumpeter's meteorological metaphor focus us on the extreme weather created by capitalism in both an ecological and socio-economic sense. Betty was discussing the line and the impacts of perceived scarcity to understand the psyche of voters in upcoming elections, but I think it also illuminates the need to create conditions and visions for sharing resources differently in the face of climate change and the pandemic and in everyday struggles. Limits of empathy. In Aotearoa, people coming of age in the late 90s and first decade of the 2000s were born during a time of economic restructuring. Working class people had been thrown into line with these gales of creative destruction, further entrenching the impacts of colonial capitalism. By the mid-2000s, many young Pākehā artists were experiencing a confluence of anti-colonial and climate consciousness. Land occupations in the 1990s had been live broadcast, and events like the passing of the Foreshore and Seabed Act 2004 and the subsequent protest hikoi furthered awareness. Conversations about rising sea levels were happening at the same time as conversations about rights to that changing space between high water and low water. For elder millennials, our 20s were punctuated by big global and local events like 9/11 and the earthquakes in Ōtautahi. I wasn't in Ōtautahi during the earthquakes. At 12:51 p.m. on the 22nd of February 2011, I climbed under my desk in the offices of Te Kura Ponamu, the correspondence school in Thorndon, Te Whanganui a Tara. Over the following hours and days, Wellingtonians looked aghast to the south. Self-absorbed by our own tremors, we just hadn't thought or considered that the big one might happen elsewhere. The spectre of the earthquake had always been tangible in Te Whanganui a Tara because we had all felt the little quakes. They were measurable. The information reported to us by GNS and the media corresponded and aligned with what we each individually felt in our bodies as the earth moved. On February 22nd, I had a realization that something felt so intensely in one place could be felt very differently in another. Something I had understood in theory, but beyond occasional proximity to violence or accidents, I hadn't felt it physically before. The climate crisis had been unfolding for decades, a seemingly imperceptible, slow-slipping event. People in positions of power, under the thumb of petrochemical and capital interests, chose not to perceive the deadly registers of atmospheric imbalance, and their voters couldn't yet feel the impacts, physically or economically. Climate change was intangible and distant. In the early 2000s, climate reporting had an air of the unknown, a projection that didn't correspond to daily experiences, until it began to align. Between 2020 and 2023, people have experienced moments where our personal lives were altered by the biological and economic realities of a global pandemic, the circulation and reproduction of life-threatening viral matter, alongside the accelerating impacts of the climate crisis. In 2020, news of early viral spread hit the airwaves at the same time as our New Year horizons became dusty pink with drift from the Australian bushfires. Moments of personal and collective grief were met with empathy as a necessary part of the emotional processes of social cohesion that allow communities to survive. At the same time, these events expose limits to that empathy. And as with climate change, the ongoing impacts of the pandemic have been felt unevenly, with access to vaccines limited to those countries who could afford them. Circular materialism. As an artist, I have been working with unstable materials and processes that involve reconfiguration and adaptation within particular situations and architectures. This often invites decomposition, but it attempts to resist a dead-end collapse. Since 2012, I've transitioned from using petrochemical latex paints and materials to bio-based ones. Initially, this came from a desire for that delaminated or peeled latex wall paint to have the capacity for rehydration, to become a hydrophilic, water-loving material. My work hasn't become about climate change or the pandemic, but these crises have focused my thinking about the limits of empathy, shaping my use of material empathy in processes of art making, decomposition and composition. There is a biopolymer aesthetics that has developed from this. Aesthetics in the sense of its root words of feeling and perceiving, beyond the retinal or the stylistic. These aesthetics are connected to plasticity, fluidity, and instability of polymers used in post-war practices where the material innovations of the war industry met consumer markets, including artists like Louise Bourgeois or Linda Benglis, who both used biopolymer and petrochemical polymers. Thinking through this history in an Aotearoa context, I focused on non-Indigenous material practices and asked artist Christine Hellyer how her awareness of land rights and ecological material relations developed over time, and at what point a specific consciousness of human-induced climate change began to influence her work. Awareness of colonial land confiscations and the ecological impacts of capitalism informed her material choices and subject matter while she was at art school during the 1960s. And she began experimenting with latex sourced from a Papakura glove manufacturer. Hellyer sourced latex from Scalarup Gumboot Factory in Ototahi, Christchurch too, to create artworks like Flotsam and Jetsam in 1970. Scalarup was a pragmatic choice rather than a conceptual one, but it does register the dominance of agricultural and colonial capitalism within our ecological and material cultures, disrupting romantic notions of unfettered New Zealand landscapes. Industrial bio-based rubber production has involved extreme violence that isn't inherent to the material. It arises in the linear systems of colonial production. This complicates any sense of innocence around bio-based materials and needs to inform transitions from petrochemical material culture. Thinking about non-Indigenous hydrofeminisms and climate resilience here in Aotearoa, the iconic material ubiquity of waterproof and water-proud gummies, repurposed in the form of artworks, offers an egalitarian way to move through floodplains.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
That was Raewyn Martin reading Circles and Lines. Up next, Isabella Loudon, Melissa McLeod and I will be reading Material Costs. This is a recorded reading from an edited transcript, rather than the original organic conversation. Material Costs, read by
Isabella Loudon,
Melissa McLeod,
and Arissa Keane. I've been thinking about guilt and its function in relation to material use and processes. I know that for me there's a constant weighing up of the varying costs of production, and a blind faith that what I do matters in some way, that its environmental impact is small and justifiable. I've noticed that guilt is a feeling that attaches to my lack of knowledge or belief in a clear solution. As artists who work primarily with objects and installation, I know you're both very aware of your work's environmental impacts through your choice of materials and the production of waste.
Yeah, I think sculpture gets disproportionately hammered with critique because materials are at the fore. They're really visible. So both this self-criticism and, to some extent, external criticism falls on us unduly, really.
I've been working with concrete for almost 10 years now, and I think a lot has changed in that time, specifically our awareness of climate change and resources. How I feel now is very different to how I felt 10 years ago. When I use concrete, I'm very aware of my health, but also that it creates waste. There will be leftovers. You can't use every little bit, and not everything works out.
That's an interesting point. What happens to the freedom to experiment when you're worried about what happens when things go wrong? It's not even waste, in terms of a wasted experiment. It's a crucial part of making and trying things out. But the word waste is so loaded, it strips it of the value it has within the rest of the process.
Right, and in my work, gravity and chance play a big part, so I can't necessarily just make it once. Sometimes the first time will be to test the idea, and then I make another version, and it's the last one that works. But the five before don't.
And they go in the bin.
Yeah, and even when I try to reuse and repurpose things, I can't save everything. I don't think I could make the kind of work I'm making without working in that way. I wouldn't make anything at all.
It's interesting, that process of making mistakes and what you do with that, and whether it can somehow be reincorporated or if it's just chucked out. Guilt is an interesting word, and I keep seeing the word responsible too. I've started to hate those two words the more I read, actually, around art's place within the climate crisis.
I'm finding it a real battle to use concrete at all now. I've been using plaster, which is not any better environmentally, really, but it's not as bad for your health. When I had my basement studio in Wellington, I would be in there for hours and there was no ventilation. I was just wearing a mask. Even then, when you're in there and you take it off, it's all still in the air. I'll feel it afterwards if I've done concrete work. And then I wonder about those people who do it for a job, all the time. When you use plaster and concrete, you get all these little shards and waste. So I've been filling up a bucket of these bits and trying to put them into new works. Some have worked when it's used as bulk fill, but mostly I do it because I feel guilty for throwing it out.
The guilt, it's attached to daily life and the need to be conscious and recycle everything. In the case of the plastic dunnage bags in my work on an east wind in 2020, how they were perceived shifted over the making time. Single-use plastic shopping bags were banned in 2019, and plastic was such a news item. Part of me didn't want to go ahead with the work.
Was that because of how you thought the work would be received?
Essentially, I was bracing myself for criticism, but interestingly, it never came. In my mind, I'd found a product that I thought was fascinating, because dunnage bags are designed to pack shipping containers and to be filled with air from different countries, which felt totally fitting conceptually. Their function made sense to my work as I was similarly filling them with sea air. And actually that sort of contrast between plastic and air was interesting. So ultimately it was a good material to work with. Equally, my material decisions extend to the freighting and afterlife of the work, the life cycle. For the air work, I'd planned for it to exist as multiple iterations. That work is a large scale once it's installed, but in its uninstalled state can fit into a small compact area on the back of a ute.
I think those considerations have increasingly come into play in awareness of the mass of a work. The residue as well, where do you put it, if you're even keeping it? And beyond that, what else could it be? Who could I give it to as a material? What industry might use it? Could it be sewn into something else? Or become linings for something? More and more this thinking becomes part of how I work when I'm starting from base up.
There's this image that NFTs and digital media are actually not taking up as much resources and space, but that's not necessarily true. In some instances, the printed version can be the better option for the environment, rather than storing billions of emails, PDFs, images, videos, etc. on the internet, which require more and more servers and more warehouses which use more energy. But because we don't see that, it's hard to recognise it as a problem.
Same as rubbish at the dump, right? We can call to mind an image of a pile of rubbish, but it's hard to comprehend or imagine the scale at which it actually exists in relation to us.
I think as artists, we don't want to own all this. I think that's why the Freeze article was interesting. The article places the onus back on art institutions. Environmental accountability needs to be embraced by the whole art mechanism, including gallery, processes and buyers. It can't be all on artists. Just as one small example, sometimes the perceived pressure to use materials we don't want to for environmental reasons is partially due to limited funding.
I think it depends on how you want the work to be read as well. If we start to look at art always through an environmentally concerned lens, then all other ideas are dulled. I love using concrete, its grittiness, its transition from liquid to solid, and the way you can cover things and it envelops them. Now though, whenever I use it, I am always concerned that the work is going to be criticised first and foremost for being materially harmful for the environment. I'm not sure if this is true, but it definitely weighs on me.
I wonder how it's possible to have it both ways and say, fuck it, I really like the material and I want to play and explore it, but also to make it work within an ethical framework which considers the environment, or if they will always be opposing priorities.
I've noticed artists who are consciously choosing natural materials, where in some instances those materials can be so loaded that the initial concept is drowned out by the material choice. In itself, the fact that an artwork can biodegrade is really interesting, but in these cases, actually it wasn't meant to be the dominant aspect of the work. But that's where our focus is directed right now, on sustainability.
I think I'm getting quite confused at the moment. I try really hard to reuse, repurpose, buy secondhand clothes, buy things that will last. But in my practice, I'm not interested in those things becoming the focus of the work. I've been working a bit with used rubber inner tubes. What drew me to the material is that it evokes something. These found materials have a past that is reflected in their surface and form. The tube also has a relationship to the body, which I like, in its softness and in the forms it makes and how it moves. Someone encountering my rubber tube works the other day asked me straight up, "So is it about recycling?" No, to me it is not. But by repurposing something that would otherwise go to waste, I do feel less guilty about making so many things in my trial and error style. But it doesn't erase the fact that it still exists as unnecessary stuff and ultimately as waste.
And then we come back to that point where we have to remember that it is somehow necessary. Otherwise, a lot of people would be talking themselves out of making anything at all. Some already have made that choice.
I have to remind myself that art still has a place and an important role in why we exist. It'd be pretty boring if there was none. I feel particularly driven to make things out of materials, not necessarily with art as the outcome, but to engage in processes that are tactile and physical. Material stuff plays an important role in how we share thoughts, emotions, and ideas with other people.
I think our environmental footprint is just another layer to a complex maze you have already entered. The commitment to practice means you have already decided to take on all hurdles and stubbornly make and push back. We are clever people. We can find ways to operate within this crisis if we really want to, if we value what we're saying. Art is about offering another angle. I live in a community that is often unheard, seeing in action, and rising tides increasingly inundate the neighbourhood. Art practice for me is about finding a voice. But I'm interested in injecting these politics as a layer within the works so they can quietly filter through, so they're not shouting. We were talking about what people are criticising material-wise, and I was thinking about how it's easy to target certain materials like plastic and concrete. But there are sneaky little ones as well. Sand, for example, it's in concrete, and then there is its role in glass production. The mining of it globally is fraught with numerous ethical issues on a human and environmental level. It is a finite and abused resource worth billions. Here in New Zealand, Pākeri is just one example of a mined area where practices are unsustainable and impacting the coastal area. And historically, this is a largely unmonitored process. We seem to see sand as an unending natural material for some reason. It's important to me to be informed about everything I'm using. And I don't know whether that need is maybe increased over time, this need to feel completely like you know the material inside out. I was really keen to learn where Fulton Hogan got the sand from that I used in Salt of the Earth, but I probably wouldn't have been so interested in that 10 years ago. I think a big part of feeling better about using materials is understanding their supply chain so you can see it. It's also about being able to speak with integrity to your material decisions, being able to stand up for what you've done. Then you can start to direct sculptural remnants to other industries as well, or bring these industries on board. It doesn't always happen, but it's a nice feeling when it all aligns. Again, it's sort of that cycle. For example, the sand I used was passed onto a local housing company. It became the groundwork for a building development across the paddock.
I prefer not to know where things come from, or to know too much about them. I feel it affects my initial impressions of a material and freedom to explore what it can do. By finding materials rather than buying them, they come loaded with their own history. It's just not one I can know. But there is something liberating in redirecting or repurposing a material that would otherwise go to waste. Also, making art is expensive, and the more that's free, the better. When I went to Whanganui, I went to a bike shop and asked, "Have you got any old bike tubes?" They gave me a barrel. But you know, those people were holding on to them. More people are holding on to things, I think, because they don't want to throw them out. So I definitely feel like I'm doing something good with those. I'm using them in an artwork, but what happens after that?
It's interesting, too, to consider that artists aren't always making good work. Not all environmental artwork is successful, and what they're talking about might be being done better by a community project or by a scientifically led group. Sometimes artists are not very good at editing what we think is worthy and appropriate subject matter. Sometimes art's not the best vehicle or medium.
There are times when it would be just as good or better to be simply pointing at a thing, like to use your voice or platform to just point at these things that already exist, to the people who have already done the work. It can seem a bit parasitic when artists take from these initiatives if it's not done in a particular and sensitive way.
That's when it hasn't had a shift, has it? Artists have taken something real and researched and haven't reimagined it. I think the shift in that process is where this topic can become interesting, when something quite banal is manipulated and can be seen from a different angle. We have to be really aware of not just taking, which can easily occur, and thinking that putting an idea in a gallery is all it needs. That is something I'm really aware of because I'm often dealing with scientific research. It's really crucial that you're sensitive around that because you are just dipping a toe compared to someone who's been studying a specialty area for 50 years. You're taking some often really detailed, fascinating material that is totally someone's world and sort of using what you need from it.
And it's easy to think that it's justified because the artist is representing that information to a public that might not otherwise be exposed to it. But that's not always enough. I'm guilty of being drawn to a specific and poetic idea from science and wondering what I can do with it. It's a trope of art making once you start recognising it. It's when that next step hasn't been taken or hasn't been executed in full that we're talking about being potentially harmful in its purposelessness. I know that science fiction and speculative fiction is becoming quite a good vehicle for imagining the future in terms of climate adjustment, and artists are looking to fiction increasingly. It does take from science and it presents it for its own ends, but it does so in a generative way.
It's a really integral relationship at the moment for artists that want to be a voice for climate crisis. It's pertinent, I think, in being able to learn from other research worlds and speak from a place of knowledge, because you can't come up with everything, you know. I mean, why would you come up with everything yourself? There are other industries and researchers out there that are interested in that collaboration. Currently, I'm looking at taking sea samples from areas of flooded houses. There's lots of scientific information from the likes of the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, NIWA, and studies that have been done around these impacted communities. But it's really delicate because I'm also dealing with people's lived experiences of having had their houses and lives devastated. I'm conscious of the need to stand back and remember where my practice sits within this very real and lived space. There's a balance to find when you're essentially using experiences of environmental crises and wanting to make an art show from it.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
That was Material Costs, read by Isabella Loudon, Melissa McLeod, and me, Orissa Keane. In researching this topic, we looked to these sources and more for reference. We mentioned the Freeze article, which is called Challenging the World's Material Waste, from 2021, by Tom Jeffries, found on the Freeze website. The essay discusses Helen Mirren's 2019 manifesto, Cathartes 19, setting out a series of principles and practices responding to concerns for climate collapse, plastic waste, and the treatment of non-human living beings. A full PDF is downloadable from Helen Mirren's website. And here is some basic information about sand mining from Friends of Pākehi Beach, an organisation aiming to stop sand mining at Pākehi. The legal battle is ongoing against the McCallum brothers. Find more at friendsofpakiribeach.org.nz.
You've just heard Material Costs, a conversation between Isabel Loudon, Melissa McLeod, and me, Orissa Keane. Next is Lulu Callister-Baker reading her short story, Melancholic Melanella.
For 30 years, her ex had been eating plastic. But unlike the plastic in everyone else, the plastic didn't leave him. Instead, it floated in his bloodstream and lodged in his organs. She deduced this on the day he broke up with her. It was midnight at his parents' and he had fallen asleep with his arms wrapped around her. As he slept, she observed things about him she hadn't before, like his veins, which ebbed with an iridescent glow. She peered closer and saw tiny dots of light darting beneath his skin. She watched him circulate around his body, like seeing car lights along a motorway from high above. She had heard that people consume one credit card's mass of microplastic every week. She didn't know much about biology, but guessed what she was seeing was the plastic, and resolved to fix him. 3 months later, it rained hard overnight. The next morning, on her walk to work, there were worms all over the footpath. They writhed in the sun, displaced. They reminded her of an article she had read about the larvae of wax moths, called waxworms, that could break down plastic with the enzymes in their saliva. She suddenly knew how she could fix her ex. She called him. "I'm sorry I didn't tell you this earlier, but you are filled with plastic that glows in the dark. The only way to fix you is to feed you to worms that can eat it. But for this to work, the worms will have to eat all of you, not just the plastic," she said. His breaths punctured small holes in the silence. He sighed. "I have been sick for a long time. I'll try anything if it means I don't have to feel like this anymore." If there was something that could bring them together again, she thought, it was their mutual interest in him. It took some time and most of her savings, but she managed to obtain enough larvae to fill her bath. She watched them crawl and twist over each other. Their thin, segmented bodies had the same textures and colours as empty pippy shells washed up on the beach. If she squinted, they became a repulsive breathing mass. She invited her ex to take a seat on the couch in the living room. She paced back and forth as she talked him through what was going to happen. His face was pinkish, like he was holding his breath, and he wouldn't look at her. When she finished, he stood up and took the codeine and the bottle of water she had bought him. He put his headphones on and went into the bathroom, closing the door behind him. She heard him gasp as he stepped into the bath. An hour later, she went in. He had pulled the shower curtain across the bath so she couldn't see him. She quietly picked up his clothes from the floor. Later, she donated them to an op shop. She left her ex in the bath with the waxworms for several weeks. While he was not their normal food, they seemed to make do. They burrowed into his skin and then into his organs where the plastic had lodged. Each day, the determined chewing sounds from behind the shower curtain reassured her. They were eating all of him, even the polyethylene. One morning, she went to brush her teeth after breakfast. The silence made her skin prickle. She pulled back the shower curtain and examined the scene. The waxworms had wrapped silk cocoons around their plump bodies, which were nestled within divots along her ex's bones. Relieved, she left them to transform. Later, she heard a whirring from the bathroom, like the hum of an industrial electric generator. She slowly opened the door and felt thousands of simultaneous tiny bursts of air against her face, arms, and legs. There were wax moths everywhere. The ones that weren't flying rolled like waves all over the toothbrushes, sink, toilet, and shower. But unlike any other wax moths she'd seen when she'd researched them online, their bodies glowed, just like the plastic had in her ex's veins. All at once, the moths froze, then funneled out the open bathroom window. Not long after, about a week, she stood on the outskirts of the community garden near her home and watched a woman spray the beehives with a carbon dioxide fumigant. She had seen the notice about this stuck to the community garden gate. Since, she had been checking each day for the fumigator and preparing herself for what she had accepted was inevitable. The moths had attracted other moths using their ultrasonic pulses and mated. They had laid their eggs throughout the bee combs and were aware of the beehives in the community garden. The larvae that had hatched were now eating through the beehives, slowly destroying them. As she watched the fumigator, she noticed strange bursts of light around the beehives, like pin-sized fireworks. The woman didn't seem to notice them, possibly ignoring them, as she continued to spray. The pins of light sprayed upwards, popped, then plunged down into the grass below, trailed by thin squiggles of smoke. She left the fumigator to finish the job and returned home.
That was Lulu Callister-Baker reading Melancholic Melanella. And that's all for now. Thanks very much for listening to this selection of readings from Correspondence 3.1. You can pick up a copy from our gallery and a few other places around the Motu listed on our website, or access the full publication online. In a later episode, we'll share the remaining text contributions from Correspondence 3.1, including those by Hannah Peroake, Takawiho Hoskins, and Alison Jones. Currently showing at the Physics Room is I'm So Into You, which will be open Tuesday to Friday, 11 a.m. till 5 p.m, and Saturday and Sunday, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m, here at the Physics Room, at 301 Montreal Street, Ōtautahi, Christchurch. The show will be up until the 28th of March, closing at Easter. Our next exhibition will feature artists Akil Ahmad, Olivia Hong, and Zumoy Jing, running from April 5th till the 19th of May. Thank you for listening, and tune in next month on Rāmere, 19th of April, 8 p.m, for our next episode of Art Not Science. Ngā mihi o te wā!
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.